This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio with me Vivek Chibber, one of the co-editors of the Socialist Register and an associate professor of sociology at NYU. When he was a grad student at the University of Wisconsin, he was hailed as one of the brightest stars to be here. So, Vivek Chibber, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you, Matt, for that very embarrassing introduction.
It's true, though. All my professor friends were touting you. I wanted to talk about the latest issue of Socialist Register, which I got a copy of, in which you're the co-editor of. The title is The Crisis This Time. Do you want to explain the crisis?
Yeah, and I'll say something about the actual wording of the title as well. We decided to call it The Crisis This Time because it evokes a very important sense, a very important fact about capitalism, which is that it's an economic system that's intrinsically unstable and which has gone through a number of very deep, very prolonged crises in its history. And this goes against the prevailing vision in the economics profession, in the mainstream economics profession, which is that it is a self-equilibrating system, not just in the sense that it restores balance whenever there's imbalance, but that imbalance itself is an unusual and pathological phenomenon within capitalism. And the view that's been held by radicals now for at least a century, especially by Marxists, but not just by Marxists, also by left-wing Keynesians, also by people coming out of the anarchist tradition, is that the basic characteristic of capitalism is a boom and bust. So the fact that this crisis occurred now ought not to be seen as an aberration within capitalism, but as the latest instance of a recurring pattern, and hence the title.
Now, is there? There's a sense that I get sometimes from Marxist economists who claim that the system is always in crisis, and that makes the definition or the defining characteristics of this crisis harder to pinpoint, or the magnitude or severity of the crisis this time to really measure. How would you assess that?
Yeah, I think it's misleading to say that it's always in crisis. You could make it true by redefining the word crisis and by shifting its meaning from sentence to sentence. So what people sometimes do when they say it's always in crisis is they shift away from what the narrow definition of crisis, which is a breakdown of production, a slowdown in profits, an increase in unemployment, and they shift it instead to, say, the quality of people's lives or the incidence of poverty. And, of course, those are social crises, but when radical economists normally talk about crisis, what they mean is a narrow definition of crisis.
And what is the particularity of this particular crisis we've been going through the last 3 years?
Well, the particularity probably has to do with the extraordinary role of finance within this crisis and the transmission channels from finance into the domain of profits. But I actually think that while the particularities need to be examined, for radicals, it's important to see really the elements of continuity from past crises. And that has to do with how the halt in production and the slowdown in production came out of the decline in profits that came about over the last 2 years with the housing crisis, through the housing crisis. And it speaks again to the fact that in capitalism, what production turns on is simply this, not whether people need goods or not whether there's a demand for goods out there, but whether or not the people who control investment think that the returns on their investment are adequate to actually undertaking the effort for the investment. And that speaks to something very important, which is that in capitalism, human needs and human interests are constantly subordinated to profits. I think that's what is really important. The continuity between this crisis and the past ones is what stands out in that respect.
Another thing that stands out to me is just that the ruling class, the owners of capital, Wall Street, whatever you want to call it, has control of the state and is just come out of this, fat and happy as ever.
Absolutely. In fact, in many ways, this crisis stands out. The naked power and the absolute shamelessness with which the Obama administration turned over the public exchequer to Wall Street and to Main Street. And it's important to realize there's a there's this view out there that Obama reacted very differently with respect to Wall Street than he did with Main Street, which that he sort of gave everything over to Wall Street that they needed, but he was harsh, you know, with the corporations. And that's absolutely untrue. Well, I think what Obama, if you look at how he reacted to the collapse of the auto industry, it's pretty clear he gave them everything they wanted, not just with regard to helping push through a restructuring of the industry, which the industry was either unwilling or incapable of doing on its own, but the way he dealt with the unions, forcing the unions to absorb so many of the costs, and in the end coming up with, I think, a model for the Democratic Party, which is different from the Republicans, as to how to deal with the unions. The Republicans have taken up the strategy of simply a full frontal assault of dissolving collective bargaining rights. And that has its, from their standpoint, I can see the merits that it has strategically. The Democrat strategy, as shown by Obama, has been different. And that's been to keep the legal rights of unions intact, but simply to make it irrational for any worker to ever want to join one. So what he did with the auto workers was, with the auto unions, he forced them to scale down their benefits and scale down the terms of membership for them so that they were harmonized with non-unionized workers in plants in the South. So the idea is, if union members don't see any benefits coming out of being in a union, why would they want to keep paying dues?
Right.
And that's a much less conflictual way of approaching the same dilemma.
And wages have dropped in the unionized plants, at least for new hires, to the level of the non-unionized plants in the South. But so why would Obama do that? I mean, here is a guy who was swept to power by several different constituencies, but certainly by labor, which poured $300 million in and did a lot of legwork to get him elected, progressives, African-Americans, Latinos, and yet, as you say, he hasn't gone to bat for organized labor. He didn't go to bat for the Employee Free Choice Act. In fact, he just sat on it, and he's doing these free trade agreements, and he did this thing with the auto unions, and also, if we get to health care, you know, he ridiculed or mocked the so-called Cadillac health plans that the unions had bargained for hard over time. Why this disdain for labor, which helped bring him to power?
I think two basic reasons for that. One is unions played a role in Obama's coming to power, but they're second fiddle. They're second fiddle to the corporate interests that helped bring him to power. And Obama, like any other president, any other Democratic president, has to look at corporate interests through two very important lenses, and both lenses trump the place of labor in his strategy. The first is that corporate donations and corporate backing vastly overwhelms whatever unions can do for him, which is not to trivialize what unions do, but it does overwhelm it. But there's a deeper problem that Obama faces, which is that here he is in the middle of a recession, and the first thing he needs to do is to try to get the economy back on track. And getting the economy back on track means somehow getting investment back up. And unfortunately, investment is in the hands of business owners, large corporations, small corporations. This is true for every president, whether Republican or Democrat. Insofar as they need to keep the economy humming along, they have to prioritize business interests. The only time they don't is when they're compelled not to. And that compulsion comes out of a mobilized and active labor movement. What's happened over the past few years is labor, as it's become weaker and weaker and weaker, is both unwilling and incapable of launching any kind of major mobilization. So what they try to do instead is curry favor with the Democrats instead of pushing their agenda onto them.
So it's begging more than anything.
It's exactly what it is. And, you know, it's been 30 years now, 35 years now, where what they've gotten in return from the Democrats is a softer and milder version of what they're getting from the Republicans. But the truth is they have nowhere else to go.
I know that Obama has gone back to Wall Street to try to cash in for more campaign contributions to this sector that was one of his biggest supporters. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive. You're listening to Progressive Radio. My guest today, Vivek Chibber, one of the co-editors of The Socialist Register and associate professor of sociology at NYU. There's one other thing that can compel public sector spending, and that is economic crisis itself. And that's what happened with Obama when he came in. And to some extent with Bush and the bailout. I mean, it was just, you know, empty the treasury and give it to the banks was Bush and Obama's policy. And then the stimulus that did create 2-3 million jobs that Obama did, and that may have been designed less to placate organized labor and more to say, you know, I got to get reelected. We got to do something about this economy that's going to crash. And yet he came in at with half a loaf. I mean, he could have done a lot more. When he had the power, it seems to me, he was urged to do so every day in the New York Times when Paul Krugman had a column, and he kept rewriting the same column. And yet he came up short. Why do you think he shortchanged himself in a way?
I think it speaks to the transformation of the Democratic Party over the last 30 years. I think that if this crisis had occurred, a crisis of this magnitude and this depth had occurred even in the mid-60s, you would have seen a somewhat different response from the Democratic Party. For a couple of reasons. One is organized labor did have much more of an institutionalized presence within the Democrats at the time. And the Democrats themselves still had some of the generation of the New Deal Dems inside the party, and memories of the New Deal were around, in which at which time the response had been, in the end, in the Roosevelt administration, especially the second Roosevelt administration. It turned out to be quite different from this one. What's happened over the past 30 years is that the Democratic Party has been so transformed by the corporate takeover of the party. And Obama is so much a product of that culture that even when the structural space is there for them to do something, and even when they know they have the political backing and the social consensus to support such a thing, they neither have the inclination nor the vision to back it. Obama is, I think, deeply wedded to the notion that the Democratic Party must keep business and Wall Street on its side. Otherwise, they see for themselves being sidelined by the Republicans, who are the natural party of both of these interests.
And the only time that Obama really had that political power was in the first 6 months that he was in office.
Yeah, and you saw what he did. The moment he came into power, he moved so fast to sideline and to marginalize even the mildly progressive elements within his administration. He took things off that, you know, healthcare is a great example. Here were the pharmaceuticals and the insurance companies who anticipated that they would take a beating and had already said they were willing to make concessions because they anticipated that single payer would at least be on the table. The first thing Obama does when he comes into office is he cuts a deal with them and he assures them that it won't be on the table. What that shows you is that it's not that he pushed the envelope as far as he could and then he saw that they're resisting and so then he backed down. He preempted any possibility of pushing the envelope, which means that he already had in his head this notion that this is something that our party, if it's to remain in power, it can't actually sustain.
And that's because he wants to go back fishing for donations from the pharmaceutical and healthcare companies, or is there something else?
Well, I don't think it's just as crass. I mean, it's donations, but it's in a deeper sense, he wants to keep their political support. The American, you know, the electoral system is very odd. It runs on private money. That's what sustains it. And at a level that's far greater than any other advanced industrial country. And elections in America are such that before you compete over votes, you have to compete over funders. So it just becomes part of the planning strategy of both parties that the first order of business is to outcompete the other party in keeping business interests on your side. So it's not that he's actually looking for dollars from the pharmaceutical industry, but he knows that this is a signal to the business community at large. If I take on these guys, I'm sending out a signal that my party will not be the party of business anymore. And he's right. It won't.
And part of it is a blindness to what he really could do or who he could really represent or serve. I mean, I'm thinking of Geithner, for instance, at Treasury, who said shortly after the Obama bailout of the banks or the revived bailout of the banks that my job is to keep the private system of finance going in this country.
Yeah.
That's the Treasury Secretary. He didn't say my job is to get the economy going for everybody. You know,
yeah.
He viewed himself as the head of Wall Street in Washington.
That's exactly right. I mean, Sweden in the 1990s nationalized their banking system when it went into crisis, and then they reprivatized it. It was never seen as anything other than a temporary measure, and in the end, it was never seen as the opening salvo in an attempt to take over the economy or something. Obama wouldn't even contemplate that. Right. What he ought to have been done, but there ought to have been views out there and some debate over why there should be private banking at all. Why can't the banking system be run as a public utility?
I know, and that's what we were editorializing in the Progressive, nationalize the banks, or at least Bank of America and Citicorp, who we bailed out and overpaid for anyway.
Not only did he not nationalize them, he didn't even get a quid pro quo from them. It was outright gifts.
And what should the quid pro quo have been?
Oh, it should have been a complete... There are two elements to it. One is there should have been a reinstatement of the regulations through which some of the practices of banking which led to this crisis ought to have been averted. But the second ought to have been, there should have been a complete redrawing of the way banking does its business, especially with regard to poor neighborhoods, housing policy, student loans. I mean, they're become loan sharks with universities now. There should have been a redrawing of the way it deals with low-income households. There should have been deep public subsidization of schools, of housing, all these things.
I mean, they could have forgiven all the student loans. They could have reduced everybody's principal on their mortgage. That would have helped everybody. But they didn't do a single thing that helped anybody other than the banks.
They didn't even entertain the idea. They didn't even entertain the notion. Right?
It's amazing, isn't it?
It's actually quite phenomenal. But what's even more phenomenal to me, I have to admit, is the extent to which so much of the intelligentsia in this country is unwilling to even raise this issue. In left magazines and progressive magazines, it's still, and you know, of course, I know that only a small portion of the population actually reads these, but it's something, and if something, it has to start somewhere. There I admire Paul Krugman, and he's allowed his moral outrage to actually teach him something.
He pushed him to the left, actually.
And there's no doubt about it. Both he and Stiglitz have done great work, I think, in coming out there. But the liberal intelligentsia has failed in this regard. They're still trapped in this notion that no matter what Obama does, as long as it's not as bad as the Republicans, we can't come out in public and oppose him. And I think that's a huge mistake.
And I hear that every day from friends and from subscribers to The Progressive. Why are you so hard on Obama? Do you want the Republicans to win? What's your answer to that?
No, you don't want the Republicans to win. And it's perfectly fine to, you know, if you want to vote for Obama, go ahead. But learn something from the Republicans. The Republicans have for 30 years been driven to the right, not just by corporate donations, but by having a very active base that constantly holds their feet to the fire, that pushes them to the right. And the minimum, the least you should be able to do with the Democrats is to hold them accountable to the promises that they have made. But to give them a blank check and to give them a free pass on every time they break their promises simply because the Republicans manage to outdo them, that's not politics at all. There's nothing political about that.
You've got Vivek Chhibber in your latest issue of Socialist Register, a pretty startling statement in the preface there, you and your other two co-editors. You say the left is the weakest it's been since the defeat of the Paris Commune. That's 1871.
I think that's generous.
Really? But there's been, I don't know if that's so true internationally, because we had all these leftist governments come to power in Latin America over the last 20 years. You've written and talked about socialism in the South. Why isn't that a promising thing?
Well, I think it is. I think especially if we're talking about the global South, I think that's where most of the energy is right now. When we wrote this preface, we had the Atlantic world in mind more than anything else. I wouldn't want to absolve us too much, though, of our responsibility for making that statement, even in the South. The left-wing parties that have come to power, in Latin America is the main example here, those parties have moved very quickly away from their initial platforms and from their initial promises. Lula is the best example of this. Chavez's record is positive, but it's also dubious because, you know, he does have very strong caudillo tendencies, centralizing power, extending patronage, and it's a mixed record over there. But I think the biggest disappointment has been Brazil. The Workers' Party in the 90s was many of us on the left. I was a student here in Madison then, and we saw for the Global South the most exciting developments being three. South Korea, where the student and workers' movement was becoming so radical. South Africa, which was the largest and most class-conscious working class, not just in the South, but probably anywhere at the time. And then, of course, Brazil. And Brazil was really exciting because the Workers' Party had some promise of not only being a truly radical party, but being the first post-Leninist party on the left, which took inter-party democracy very seriously and liberal freedoms very seriously. And Lula's very rapid movement towards the center and towards the right has been, you know, quite a disappointment. So I wouldn't want to be too congratulatory about the left in the Global South either. It's very good. It's very important. But it is nowhere near as ambitious in its vision as the left was in the 40s and 50s, even in Latin America.
Well, let's go back to the Atlantic then. What about the fight back in Greece or in France or in Britain and or here in Wisconsin.
Those are all very promising. Those are all very, very promising, but they're just the first initial steps. They're encouraging because it's a level of activism and an intensity that we haven't seen in probably, except for France, which has been pretty encouraging for over 10 years now. But elsewhere, it hasn't been this intense for quite a while, for at least 20 years. And it's very good. But it's important to understand that for these to trigger a revitalization of the left, it's going to have to be a much longer, much deeper struggle and a much longer presence out on the streets. In Greece, the radicalization has occurred, but with no real payoffs in electoral victories or in the shifts in policies. Same as the case in Portugal. In France, the movement was fantastic, but let's face it, in the end, Sarkozy won. He got what he wanted. And it has to be now the first. We don't know whether this means a tilt back towards the right in France, or whether Sarkozy's victory is simply a tactical victory within a more long-term vitalization of the left. Germany's also, the rise of the Linkspartei in Germany has been encouraging. But in all these, we have to be very clear, the momentum is still with the right, overwhelmingly so.
Well, you know, what's behind that? You mentioned France. I mean, Le Pen's daughter is rising there. The right in America certainly has been bold and aggressive and about as ugly as you can be. Why has the right prevailed in this crisis so far?
I think it's a direct outgrowth of two things. One is that when crises occur, even when the Great Depression occurred in the 1930s, the initial momentum goes to the right. It does so because the state and state managers automatically go to business to ask them what to do to get the economy back on track. And business first priority is to restore profits, and the quickest way to restore profits is by cutting costs. And you cut costs by attacking labor, and that's what's happening in the U.S. It's what's happening in Europe. So that's the trigger. But at the same time, I think, especially in Europe, but also in the United States, the continuing momentum on the right has to be partly attributed to the abject failure of traditional social democracy. The social democratic parties all over Europe have largely now embraced a market of, not a free market, but a market-based politics and a market agenda. The SPD in Germany has become outright, I think, a neoliberal party. The Blairites in England they have done away with their associations with labor. The socialists in France are almost indistinguishable from the right. The problem is that the social forces, working people, the poor who come out on the streets, they are easily sidetracked into these established channels of protest, which are all linked up now with establishment politics. There's no, until they break away from these, which they've managed to do in France to some extent, I don't see the chances.
I'm speaking with Vivek Chibber. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at the Progressive Magazine. This is Progressive Radio. Why did social democracy fail in most of Europe? Why did they sign up with neoliberalism?
Well, there's a very deep structural component to that, which is that social democrats, when they came to power, what they found is what any party finds in capitalism, which is that when you're running the government, you have the first order of priorities to keep the economy going along at a healthy tick. If the economy tanks, then whatever you want to do becomes impossible. You know, you go into debt, start running deficits, you don't have revenues anymore, people are getting unemployed, they're getting pissed off at you. So to keeping the economy going at a steady pitch is your first order of business. And what's the condition for doing that? It's to keep business happy. It's what business keeps saying to Obama right now. You have to keep a friendly investment climate. So social democrats found that there was a basic contradiction, a basic problem they had to deal with. Their constituency was labor, which wanted better conditions of life for itself. But they ended up being beholden to business in order, as a precondition to making anything possible for labor.
And why couldn't they just expand the public sector?
Some of them did, but for some of them, there's an interesting contrast here between Sweden and France. In France, they expanded the public sector after World War II, largely because French business was so discredited because of all of its dalliance with fascism, and the French Communist Party was so popular because of its leading role in the resistance that de Gaulle really had very little option but to push through some kind of large public sector. In Sweden, the Social Democrats had to cut a deal with Swedish business, saying, and business said, we will abide by your setting up of this system, what's called a tripartite system in Sweden, where you have bargaining, peak level bargaining between business and labor. They said, we'll do that, but you take nationalization off the table. Because if you're going to give labor so much power in policy making, then you can't also give them the national economy in the form of a public sector. But the other thing you have to keep in mind is, all across the world, this is especially true in the South, social democrats were very careful about what they put into the public sector. And what they largely put into the public sector was parts of the economy that private business didn't have much of an interest in. So they didn't end up threatening private business very much at all. And after a period of time, when business thought that the public sector had absorbed all the risks, developed enough infrastructure, and those undertakings in the public sector had set up their sales networks and were potentially profit-making viable entities, that's when they started demanding privatization. And it's been quite successful across the board. This is important to understand because, Matt, I think for progressives, the biggest problem we have to think about now, and this is something the Socialist Register will take up in the next volume, is what does an anti-capitalist strategy mean in the 21st century, given that the two strategies that were tried in the 20th century, which is a kind of Leninist strategy of, you know, a kind of a vanguard party and taking over the through and that takes over the economy through nationalizing it, and the social democratic strategy, both of which came out of the early 1900s. You know, the social democrats were the inheritors of Kautsky and Bernstein, and the Leninists were, of course, the inheritors of Stalin, Lenin, and to some extent Trotsky. Both of these have largely failed, and what we need to do now is start thinking very hard about moving again away from a profit-driven economy, but thinking of ways of doing it that don't fall into the traps that the social democrats fell into, which is over time becoming left-wing neoliberals, and which the Leninists fell into, which is setting up these horrible systems in which you have an unaccountable bureaucracy and economic stagnation.
We only have a minute left. Do you mind giving us a glimpse of what that another option would be?
I can't. I think this is the dilemma for us now, and this is where I think, unfortunately, what we were hoping groups like the Workers' Party in Brazil would allow us to do is where it's fallen down, and we haven't. I mean, I can say some broad principles about what I think any viable project will have to do. I think that the most important, politically, you have to avoid what Leninists did, which is taking away people's political liberties, allowing for a free press, allowing for constitutional rights, etc. Secondly, I think that whatever economic system we have will have to be one which substantially minimizes the role of profits and profit-making. That could be done through a large public sector, but it could also be done through a very serious regulation of the private sector. I doubt that a fully planned economy is possible. I suspect we'll have to have some role for markets in any kind of decent and viable system. I think we should treat it as a practical problem, which is how deep and how extensive the markets are should be seen as what is viable and what is not.
On that note, we're going to have to stop, and we're going to have to see how that experiment, this political opening that still exists, how we can take advantage of it, if we do. My guest this week has been Vivek Chibber. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive Magazine. This has been Progressive Radio. I'll see you next week. And Vivek Chibber, thanks so much for being my guest.
Thank you, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.